Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 12, 2019. This is the seventh week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sika Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight we're looking at the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, and we're going to look at the whole path. These right speech, right action, right livelihood, being mindful of our thoughts, words, and deeds moment by moment as we interact with the world and as we interact with ourselves. An important component of right speech is the story we keep telling ourselves, and that be framed by right speech. But it's not just that. And the reason why I'm saying that is often, especially today, modern Buddhism has a strong cult side to it, I'll put it that way, called engaged Buddhism. And most of that type of Buddhism is be a good person and treat people good, all good things to do. And that should be your practice, engage Buddhism. Always, and in fact, sometimes it goes so far as to go beyond right speech, right action, right livelihood, and to start taking up causes that usually end up bringing up a lot of anger in those types of folks that consider themselves engaged Buddhists. It's not something that the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught not just to be engaged, but to be engaged from a well-concentrated mind that is rooted in wisdom and understanding. And in that way, we avoid hurting other people and ourselves with our good intentions. And some good examples of that would be the Christian Crusades or the modern jihads and all those other kinds of organized movements to change other people. In some ways, we're going to save some souls by forcing people to do this and do that. There's nothing Buddhist or there's nothing wise about any of that. And using that type of thinking to force yourself to change before you have the wisdom to change is only hurting yourself and usually comes out in very hurtful behaviors eventually too. I don't want to get too negative about this, but the reason why the Buddha didn't teach go and meditate and be good, it would have saved him a lot of talking, wouldn't it? It would have saved me a lot of talking. Just be a good person and go and meditate once in a while. But he knew that it was that the issue wasn't that we just didn't we didn't have enough righteous direction in our lives or enough people telling us to act a certain way or a belief that we should act a certain way. We lacked a basic understanding of who we are in relation to the world we live in, and that's why we act in ways that are hurtful towards others and towards ourselves, whether it's intentioned or not. I remember there were a lot of times that, should I use that? There were more times that I'd like to admit that I hurt people inadvertently or hurt myself inadvertently, meaning no intention behind it. And after the hurt was done, I couldn't even understand why I acted in a certain way towards others or towards myself, but that's because I was lacking the framework and understanding. And that type of confused reaction to my own behavior leads to further ignorance. In other words, we create scenarios as to why I acted. That person did this to me, so I'm justified in doing this. Or the situation is such that I'm justified in acting in a certain way. All of those are rationalizations for continued eye-making. The Buddha realized that. This was common during his time. And so he taught a complete eightfold path that includes virtuous behavior that is supported and informed by a well-concentrated mind and having the wisdom to understand why we act appropriately with right speech, right action, or right livelihood. Is that clear? Is it clear that it's not enough to just decide, okay, I'm going to be a good person, and that will naturally flow? Yes. Is it?
I don't think I'm really skilled enough to know. For instance, the negatives you've just explained is when you're trying to inflict your ego or your wrong thinking or your onto somebody else. I don't think in a day-to-day situation I'm that skilled to enough to know when I'm not coming from ego and wrong thought, and when I'm truly disengaged with my ego to give advice or do something. It's very complicated in a day-to-day situation.
It is, but I would argue with you saying that you do know, because we've talked about it. When our minds are agitated and distressed, when we're thinking of the past or the future, we're thinking about how this person is wrong, and the underlying feeling is to justify whatever I'm doing, we know it, and you know it, because of that, because of the feeling, because of the upset. And when we're interacting with the world and our mind is calm and at peace, and we're not insisting that things or people be any different than they are, we're in accordance with the Eightfold Path. And I would bet you do know that a lot of the time, maybe not consistent, or maybe not 100% of the time. Or am I putting something into your Dhamma practice that's not there?
Well, I can feel a rise of agitation in my mind when I'm trying to force my ego onto somebody else, my ego
mm-hmm.
or my conditioned thinking onto somebody else. Yeah, I do have a rise of agitation in my mind.
Yeah, we always know from when we're in touch enough with what's going on with us, and that's why it takes concentration and the right framework known as wisdom to understand this is what's occurring. Instead of I'm agitated and it's their fault or the world's fault or the president's fault or whatever it might be, to own that, take responsibility for what's occurring, it's because of the way I'm reacting to a particular situation, which means that if I am not in control of my reaction to something, I've literally lost my mind in that particular sense. And I would say you do recognize that. Sometimes it's after the fact.
Afterwards, yeah.
Yeah, but the important thing is that we recognize it. It doesn't really matter. It'd be nice to be all the way there and never have to worry about practicing restraint because it's automatic. But until we get to that point, we have to start where we are, which means recognizing when in a situation I've lost my mind. I've reacted. And now what do I do? We take a breath and recognize that and continue with Dhamma practice. Because eventually, if we get to the sutta, we'll live the sutta, we'll live the Dhamma the way the Buddha explains it here. But again, the idea that I should monitor my behavior is something you never even considered before.
Mm.
From a mindful point of view, from a framework of the Eightfold Path. And now you are. That's a significant change. It's a significant change for humanity that even one human being is doing this, yet there's a room full of people doing this.
John, isn't there a subtle, the Buddha recognized as people are on the path that he was going to need precepts. It was an acknowledgement that within this growing sangha that there had to be ways to resolve disputes and
yep.
some common rules of the road. And until you develop that concentration, so you can develop that mindfulness, there had to be these rules. And they grew, depending on whether you follow the five precepts or the seven or the 37
yeah.
as a monastic. But it really is, he had to acknowledge early that you had to have rules.
Yep.
And then as you developed, then restraint wasn't so after the fact. It became just what you were.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And remember, along with the rules came a structured society to incorporate and practice those rules. That was all part of Dhamma practice. Again, the Buddha did start out by saying, this is what I teach, this is what you do. And as the Sangha grew and difficulties came up within the Sangha, he started with precepts. And eventually, the set of rules is called the Patimoksha. I'm saying that right. And there's a lot of them. And some of them are kind of foolish, like even how you should stand when you're urinating, et cetera, et cetera. But when you take it into the community that he was establishing, all of these were necessary. And it was simply a way of first just living in the world, in this society, within a framework that didn't cause upset towards other people or towards ourselves. But it was, even the precepts were taught to provide order within the Sangha, but also to provide a framework for your own behavior, because it was important. It wasn't anything goes, you know. And one of the beliefs during the Buddhist time, and still prevalent today, is we only get one lifetime, it's limited, and we should just get everything we can and take everything we can, and we should pillage and plunder and all the rest of it. And all that's okay because there's only this one life. That was a common belief, and people still kind of live like that a lot. So these rules are important. The point I'm making about, these virtuous aspects is that right speech, right action, right livelihood covers all of our behavior in a very simple and direct way. But it's not just behavior. It's part of a whole Dhamma practice. Thank you, David. Frank, you had a question or a comment?
It could wait.
Okay, so this virtuous behavior is important, but it's not just about virtuous behavior. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make with all these words. The Sika Sutta, the Buddha addressed those gathered. Friends, there are three trainings that I teach. I teach training in heightened virtue. I teach training in heightened concentration. I teach training in heightened wisdom. And those three trainings are developed through the Eightfold Path. The training in heightened virtue brings restraint in speech, actions, and livelihood. Relates directly to the three virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. This Dhamma practitioner remains pure in their behavior at all times. They train themselves following these rules of behavior and understand the danger of even the slightest deviation. It sounds pretty strict, but remember, this is an individual practice. Now, I'm taking responsibility. It's not that the Buddha, whether he was alive or not, is telling me that I have to act a certain way. What he's really saying is, if you want to awaken and develop a calm and peaceful mind and a profound understanding of the nature of suffering, you will act this way. In other words, I'm not going to be punished if I don't, but I certainly won't be able to develop the Dhamma if I don't incorporate these rules of behavior. And even the slightest deviation, that's a line that the Buddha uses often in many different suttas, teaching the importance of being pure with the Dhamma, even the slightest deviation. This is called training in heightened virtue, simply following those rules of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Though, basically, that virtuous behavior means that we're harmless towards ourselves and others in our speech, action, and our livelihood, and our thoughts, words, and deeds. We don't gossip, because obviously gossip is hurtful, no matter what. I mean, if it's joking, it's usually hurtful. Our speech is necessary, it's useful, and it will have a desired effect. Meaning, if I'm sitting in a room of devout Muslims and I know that they have no interest in the Dhamma, it would be foolish of me to insist that they follow what I'm teaching, wouldn't it? It would be arrogant. It would be the essence of wrong speech, even though I believe that the Dhamma is something for everyone. It would be great for everybody to do it. That's an aspect of wrong speech, standing on a street corner and preaching something to someone that you know is they're not going to take up is wrong speech. I think you all know that the only place I really talk about the Dhamma is right here when an inquiry comes online. I don't talk about it to hardly anybody unless I'm asked a direct question, because that part of right speech is so important to me. And the same thing with right actions and to a certain extent right livelihood. It's harmless to myself and others. It's necessary, and it will have the desired effect. There's no sense in wasting time and energy on people that will not listen. No reason to. Right? The training in heightened concentration in jhana develops the concentration necessary to support refined mindfulness. This Dhamma practitioner remains secluded from sensory indulgence and unskillful mental qualities. And again, that just means to practice a measure of restraint as far as my own mind is concerned. You know, it's a self-referential ego self that's always grasping at more, that's never satisfied, that always wants to be constantly sensory stimulated. There's always got to be something going on. Well, we learn to guard our mind and practice restraint. And as we talked about 2 weeks ago about seclusion, the seclusion that we establish on our mat is taken off our mats, and from a well-concentrated mind, we're in the midst of the world and yet secluded from it because we have maintained control of our minds. Is that clear? That's an aspect of jhana that we take, concentration we take off our cushion. They enter and remain in the first jhana, characterized by rapture and pleasure, born of seclusion and accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. I won't get into too much of an explanation of these. We spent 7 classes on jhana, and they're there. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana. This is characterized by focused thoughts and insights begin to still. Delight and pleasure born of composure and inner assurance arise. Again, we've all experienced this during our meditations. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana. Delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and a peaceful mind prevails. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. Greed and aversion disappear. This is a development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. So again, very simple and direct instructions, and anyone can understand this. The importance of this sutta is that Buddha is giving us a framework and benchmarks to aspire to. And when we develop these, we know we're doing it. We know we're engaging in Dhamma practice as it's intended because we're having the intended results. And again, this sutta is about providing a broad framework for what we're doing in the Eightfold Path and developing these three trainings. The training in heightened wisdom brings the ending of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Through the ending of these defilements, the wise Dhamma practitioner remains in the defilement-free release from ignorance. I love that line, the defilement-free release from ignorance. The wise Dhamma practitioner has established profound wisdom, fully mindful moment by moment as life occurs. This is called heightened wisdom. These are the three trainings of my Dhamma. The training in heightened virtue, concentration, and wisdom establish persistence, steadfastness, absorption in jhana, refined mindfulness, and wise restraint. These three trainings should be practiced consistently and in all situations with unlimited concentration. These are the three trainings that bring pure understanding. Developing these three trainings, you will be called a rightly self-awakened one who has completed the path. The cessation of ignorance of Four Noble Truths and craving for self-satisfaction extinguishes the fires of passion. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. So again, a very succinct teaching. It relates a little bit to tomorrow night's talk, but what's remarkable to me in many of these suttas is the compassion of this human being that still comes through 2,600 years ago. Again, he didn't just say, this is it, you know, go read this rock edict and this is what I teach and you're on your own. From the day he awakened till the day he died, he was so concerned about other people that he would spend sutta after sutta simply encouraging people to do this simple thing, the Dhamma. It's remarkable. Thank you. Any questions about this sutta before we go around the room? Okay. Start with Matt. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everybody. Welcome, Nick. We have to understand that the condition of ignorance is automatic. It is automatic. Meaning, that's what's going to show up 9 times out of 10, mm-hmm. 10 times out of 10, unless we have a framework like this to interrupt that. Yeah. And until that framework is established, we're constantly going to be coming from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, automatically in speech and thought and action. there's nothing wrong there. That's just how it is in the beginning, until that framework is established. So once we can see ourselves in action, framed by the Eightfold Path, then we can go, oh, there I go again.
Yeah.
So it's automatic, and that, and this is why the Buddha's teaching is so profound and so repetitive, because the condition of ignorance is firmly in place, and it has to be seen again and again and again before the mind has a measure of restraint.
Yeah, thank you. You got me just, I've been thinking a lot about this, and you just got me going on it, and I mentioned it earlier. There were so many times in my life that I acted in a way that I couldn't understand. I mean, I did these things, and they weren't terrible. I mean, I never murdered anybody or did anything like that. But I couldn't understand why I was acting in a certain way. And even some of the just not feeling good about myself. So let me ask the question. Have all of you, maybe by show of hands, have any of you felt like you did something that you didn't understand why you did it?
Usually confusion.
Pardon me?
It's usually confusion.
Yeah, you don't understand. And isn't that a remarkable thing, to be living a life and not understand why you're acting a certain way? I did for a long time. And it wasn't until I developed the Dhamma until I understood that, and actually was able to let go of the harsh judgments, the self-loathing. It was only through the Dhamma that I was able to recognize that and get past it. You know, I was a bit of a wild kid, and when you're a wild kid, you do things that by nature you're not supposed to be doing. And so I was also told that you're a bad kid. I mean, that's just what, you know, that's how we discipline. You're a bad kid. And I knew I wasn't a bad kid, but I kind of thought there's something wrong with me because look at the way I'm acting. I couldn't understand it. And again, I never really hurt anybody. I never hurt anybody intentionally. But it wasn't until I developed a measure of the Dhamma that I was able to see that clearly and see the eye-making and all that self-judgment, not understanding my behavior. So, and I've talked about this often here, the great freedom that comes from actually integrating the Eightfold Path is because I know when I'm acting within this framework that I am harmless. I don't have to be second-guessing myself constantly. Of course, I've developed a lot of seclusion in my own life. Some of it is circumstantial, some of it I work towards. But what great freedom, and I think you've all experienced that too, by just knowing that if you're living within this framework of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, able to maintain a well-concentrated mind and the refined mindfulness of how to act in a harmless way. That's where all the freedom in the world is, isn't it? Because now I don't have to keep thinking about what I'm doing and why I did it. I act from a place of... And those things that all engaged Buddhists want to be come naturally from a direct Dhamma practice. So that's, I think that's my third talk tonight. So. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Just while I was reading your book in preparation for this class, reading away, thinking about it, and thinking about, and then all of a sudden the phrase "the deathless state" came into my mind.
Yeah.
And I've never, apart from outside your class, I've never thought about that phrase or understood it, or, you know, it's just a kind of something that we talk about, but it just kind of goes over my head a bit, you know, what it is. And I kind of just understood it for the first time, that the peace and the quiet and the agitation,
yeah,
that you have to the point that it's, your mind is so quiet that it's almost a deathless state. You can,
yeah,
almost describe it as a deathless state.
Yeah.
And I've never seen it, or I've never thought about it. I think probably the name itself has sort of put me off, you know, the deathless state. I mean, who wants to go there? But so it's kind of like dismissed, but it just came to mind when I was reading your chapter.
Yeah, that's great insight.
Yeah.
It refers to the end of ignorance. When Jen said on retreat, I think it was two retreats ago, that ignorance requires time. And that's what it refers to. So the deathless state is the state free of ignorance. There's nothing to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's the deathless state.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with living forever. You know, there, a lot of people would claim that. In fact, there's still some traditions that say once you awaken, poof, you vanish and you're living in Buddhist heaven forever and ever and ever. The Buddha awakened, he didn't vanish. He lived that deathless state free of ignorance for 45 years.
Okay.
Great insight.
Can I just follow on what Matt was saying about we are prone to be in ignorance. That's how we are. Isn't there some kind of like we're all prone to be awakened if we can only just get rid of the ignorance? It's like all in us. We're so distracted that we're just not living the right life.
Yeah, I'm a little bit cautious about using that reference that it's in us, just because it has connotations of an inner Buddha nature or something, which is not something the Buddha taught. There's nothing inherently in a self rooted in ignorance.
It's the nature of the five clinging aggregates to cling.
Yeah,
but it's also the nature of becoming. You have a choice.
Well, I think a better way of saying it is that each moment holds the potential to awaken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really has nothing to do with an inner something, but it does point directly to what I'm holding in mind in this moment will determine whether my next moment is rooted in ignorance or rooted in wisdom. It relates directly to the Eightfold Path.
And in that way, the condition of ignorance, the condition implies an environment.
Yep.
Space. So it's impermanent, right?
Mm.
Conditions are impermanent. So the condition of ignorance is impermanent. Ignorance in the condition of impermanence is impermanent, right?
And impermanence, you're born in ignorance, and
right.
And also in impermanence, you're awakened.
Right.
Yes. Nick was asking me about some different definitions of Four Noble Truths, and that third noble truth, cessation of suffering is possible, points directly to impermanence. If things weren't impermanent, if that wasn't the law of the land, then we would just be stuck in whatever it is we're in. But so impermanence is itself a dispassionate concept that can only be made passionate by how we interact with impermanence. When we understand impermanence, we understand the other two marks as well. They're all kind of one thing. You could classify the three marks of existence as simply suffering, because it is a misunderstanding of impermanence and what constitutes itself that results in suffering. So they're all that way. But for clarity's sake, we separate our thoughts from the environment that we're working with or working in, so that we can see what we're doing. And again, it's another, the brilliance of the Buddha was to create a framework and an underlying practice so we can actually see what we're doing. Like you just described, and we all are describing it. We need a mind that is well concentrated, and we need, and beyond that, we need a framework in which to see what's going on. That's what the three trainings are about. If it was just a training in concentration, you'd be missing the virtue and the wisdom part, wouldn't you? If it was just wisdom, so it takes all three of these trainings, but it's not anything that can't be done. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for every human being who was interested could take to it and awaken. Were you done?
Thank you, yes.
Thank you. Ram, good to see you.
I was thinking earlier, just like when you are not working with the virtuous factors. It's characterized by confusion and agitation. But when you are, all there is ease. And it's kind of a way that you can recognize, we're hitting it now.
Yeah, and you can make a decision to live like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you now have the framework and the mindful wherewithal to actually make that decision.
Right.
That's power,
you,
that's freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, once you recognize it, that, this is how it can be all the time. that's a good boost to keep your Dhamma practice together.
Yeah, it offers you a lot of self-encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
Because you realize that you are finally, when you see that, you realize you're finally gaining control of your mind and gaining control of your life. And the things that you cannot control, you learn to let go. You don't cling to them anymore. Really, great insight. Thank you. Let me invite Jane on before we go too far. Hello, Jane.
Hey, John.
Ah, you're live. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
I like what you're talking about there. I do feel like I have more power over my life now.
Yeah, and isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's also it's a gentle power, isn't it? It's not something that's feeding the ego that I need to keep proving myself. It's just, this is the way it is. This is the way I am.
I'm being able to let go of things that, you know, I don't need to hold on to. And
yeah. Yeah, it's the answer to all those things. Even when I was a little kid, I don't know why I keep thinking about this, but you know, I was so confused and frustrated even as a teenager, but it was because I just didn't understand what was going on. This changes everything. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you joined us. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. I was thinking, you know, beyond, you know, why am I behaving this way and that kind of confusion that you might have. I think it's also, if the question, why is this happening to me, is also just sort of as unnecessary.
Yep.
And if you, you know, the beauty of the Eightfold Path is that as soon as you utter those words, you can just banish them because they're worthless, and just check and see where on the path you are that will empower you to move forward. Because there's, you know, so many times in people's lives when they start asking those questions, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah.
Because they do. They're sort of non-discriminatory. Why is this happening to me? Well, now you've pegged yourself as a victim.
Yep.
That's no good place to be. So banish that, and just get back on the path and find out what you can do.
Yeah. Well said, Helen. Yeah, and if you find yourself, like the Buddha says here, even the slightest deviation, if you're deviating from the path, what do? Get back on a path. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Free of any harsh judgments. And,
yeah.
Thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. You know, that, like Helen was saying, that, you know, even the things that are perceived to be bad, they too are impermanent. And, you know, staying on the path and continuing to move forward even through difficulties. And the path really helps you, you know, maintain the optimism that you need to weather through what you, when you're not awakened, what you still feel is very difficult or feels very heavy. And then the path really allows you to lighten so much of that, to be able to go fairly quickly in a difficult situation, to know that even this too is impermanent.
Yeah.
Is a gift in itself. And certainly, you know, the virtuous factors help I think really as you're working through any difficulty. And then also what Matt said about we're all in ignorance or in it a lot, and things you've said a thousand times about it can be interrupted. And so that goes for when you think you are carrying a burden, that the thinking can be interrupted. And you know that because you'll, something will all of a sudden go your way and you'll be like, oh, okay, today's going to be okay. But it's really no different than it was before when you were thinking that this is a very heavy, dark day or difficult day. So really staying on the middle path and returning to the practice and the ease of understanding that impermanence is a good thing, too, you know, and it can be. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Kate, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
When Jen was here a couple of weeks ago, she said something that really kind of struck me.
She does that.
Yeah, I know. She has like these great one-liners. She said that sometimes she thinks that her own mind is like a computer program running amok on her, and she has like no control over it. And that kind of struck me because that's how I feel about my mind a lot. And I'm sort of slowly coming around to the realization that that is the preset. That's the factory setting. And so I'm starting to realize why this is called a practice, because you do have to practice it constantly. You may have to do it a million times. But I guess you're on the right path if you're doing that, if you're noticing it. And then also just to pick up on what you just said about deviating, I kind of like that idea because it sort of says like every moment is a chance to start fresh, to start anew. If you get off the path, you go, you know, now's the moment to get back on.
Yeah.
I like that idea, so.
Yeah, that's a great insight, Kate, and it is. Each moment holds the potential to incline my mind towards awakening or not. And that's my choice. It has nothing to do with anything else that's going on in my life or in the world. It's up to me. May I put you on a spot and ask you, have you been noticing developing concentration and allowing yourself to be somewhat disentangled from the events?
Yeah, I mean, I still do let myself get carried away and all of a sudden I'm, you know, sort of off on things. But I am recognizing it more often when I am doing that. And so that's encouraging because at least it's being noticed now. Whereas before it just was, like Matt said, it was automatic. It was just like off and running by itself. So,
yeah, that is.
Yeah.
That's Dhamma practice. That's developing concentration,
so that's
to recognize it. So good for you.
Thank you.
David, good to see you, my friend.
Just to go back to your evaluation of when you were young and you didn't understand why, you were mindless.
Yeah.
You had no tools. And I always think of the tools of what we're doing is the effort and the mindfulness and the concentration, and the barometer are the virtuous factors, and that what we're really looking to be able to get to is right view, to be able to see the Four Noble Truths for what they are, and it's a path, and you do yourself well to keep with the practice, because it is something that, it's like a muscle, it develops, and you can see just how you're talking differently now, and it's something that just builds, and if you stick with it, you know, things resonate at different times, but it just does keep building. And the worst thing you can do is take a day off. That's the worst thing you can possibly do.
But what happens if you do?
Just
get right
back on it.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah, you're right. It is, to put it that way, it is the worst thing you can do is to give up the Dhamma even for a day.
Once you know it, why would you stop it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, past a certain point, you probably won't, but a mind that's rooted in ignorance, conditioned towards that way, will come up with all kinds of reasons to stop and do something else, or even
less
do
mindless.
Yeah, it is, but it's not recognized as such. You know, you might. I gotta. I just decide if it's okay for me to talk about this. Probably not. Let me put it this way. I got an email from someone online who is very enamored with a different type of meditation practice, and they wanted to know my opinion of it. And well, you know, I gave it.
You didn't say it was a distraction, did you?
I did. And then I gave him a whole list of articles to read on my website rather than rewrite them again in this email. And I said, when you're done, please get back to me and we can talk about it. Well, 5 minutes later, I got an email that wasn't pleasant. But I understand where it's coming from, because I was challenging his view of himself and his Dhamma practice. And that's, you know, it's hard not to take that personally. But then a few days later, I got a thank you, you know. So it just needs that. It might sound like I'm telling you all how wonderful I am. The point I'm trying to make is it just took for this gentleman just a crack of pure inquiry that led him to developing the Dhamma. But it has to be there. You have to look at it. You have to develop it. You have to do these kind of things. But when you do it, it's pretty obvious that this is what works. You know, and even the languaging that we use, you know, the things that we talk about in here, not many people would understand it in general outside of this room, but that's just because we're developing a language for the Dhamma that we're developing too. That's important. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you too. How are you, John?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Good. Dave and I had this conversation over the holidays about, you know, what you do when you catch yourself going off the path. You just get back on. And Dave said, that's how I see myself now, is I am the person that, if that happens, the next thing I do is to just get back on the path. And that, I've been thinking about that a lot, and that has helped me bring things back into focus a number of times. I think of it as the default, you know, it's like the default switch, you know, when you fall back into that kind of ignorance of what you know to be true, and the resistance to, you know, taking care of your ego and the way it needs to be taken care of. The other thing I was playing around with was this idea of, as I was reading the article today, the idea of wisdom and the use of the word wisdom and how it, at a certain point, is fed by insight, and so mm-hmm. that those two words kind of go back and forth on each other.
Yep.
You know, that I know we've all had those moments where you go, oh, like even today, I'm writing things in a book as I learn them, and I'm trying to learn the suttas and what's included in the suttas, just to kind of create more of a framework for what we're talking about. And so as you write things out, and you said this last week, as you write things out, all of a sudden the insight is, oh, that goes back to this.
Mm, yeah.
And that goes over to this. And then it reminded me of Jen's drawing,
right.
You know, that just folds in and out of itself. And I've always known that it folds back. I say it all the time, but it just was so evident when I was writing these things out, how this little detail is connected to that little detail, and
yeah.
how it all kind of works into a well-made basket, you know, where everything is kind of woven together in a really good way. So that's what I've been thinking about.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. I mean, that's the reason why Matt and I structured the teacher training that way for the writing, is because it uses a different part of your brain and you learn things in a different way. So those of you that aren't doing the teacher training, I encourage you to pick it up, whether you're going to sit up here or not, because it's just a great way of learning on a much deeper level. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Very good. Good to be here. I was just thinking, I've been a part of this group now for about a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, more.
Happy birthday.
Happy anniversary.
Happy
anniversary.
And I will say that I think the things that I've learned here have changed me. But
may I ask how?
There's no going back.
Can I put you on a site?
Think I understand more about how to live better.
Yeah.
And how I act, how it affects other people. Because he said, hey, you know, and maybe it's conscious, whatever it is. I know there's something wrong, but you don't really know what that is, or you know what the impact is. And then when you start to learn more about this,
yeah,
all of a sudden it starts to make sense. And like I said, there's no going back then. Because now you know something you didn't know before. And so it's been great. So.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that, Russ. Yeah, and everything the Buddha taught, everything in the Dhamma is practical, and it develops in practical ways. Why else would we do it?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Nick, good to see you. How are you?
Good to be here. I have two questions. The
sure.
First one was that Laura's discussion at the beginning, I didn't hear the word. Was it deathless?
Deathless, yes.
Deathless. Could you enlighten me on that?
the deathless state, let me answer it this way, and I didn't really go this far before. Living a life rooted in ignorance is not living life at all. It's not just not a good life. You haven't lived your life because you've been living it from a point of view that has no relation to reality. So you may have had 80 years or 100 years on this plane, but basically it was a wasted life. It was a life characterized by ongoing death, nothing there. A life free of ignorance is the deathless state. You're fully alive. It doesn't predict living forever. It simply means that in this moment, for the first time, you're alive. Why? Because you are mindful of what's occurring, which makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if I'm living in a situation where I don't understand what I'm doing, I'm not really here, am I? That's the point. A simpler way of saying it is the Buddha's Dhamma teaches us a way to unite our mind and our body in our life as our life occurs and keep it there. There's nothing, the Buddha's word would be, there's nothing to provoke my mind out of my body and into a dead state of being. So does that answer your question?
Yes. My second question is, when I'm driving in my car and I start getting bombarded by these, my mistakes, we have to have that discussion already.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, if I'm doing a meditation, I can handle them and I can put them all away. But when I'm driving my car, I mean, I can't do a meditation while I'm driving my car, mm-hmm. but I do find that I can still put them away. Is that, that's not meditation, but is it something else?
I'm not quite following you. When you say you can put them away, you mean you
deconditioning is mine.
You're not thinking about them anymore.
Right.
That's great. That's an aspect of deepening concentration. I think there's a sutta called the Vitakkasanthana Sutta, the relaxation of thoughts. And in that sutta, the Buddha concludes it by saying, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Meaning whatever is appropriate for the situation I'm in, that will reflect my thoughts. And so that's what you're doing. You're developing that rather quickly, too. And even when you're driving, if you find yourself agitated while you're driving, probably best not to close your eyes, but to take a few breaths and just bring your mind back into your body. And oftentimes that changes everything. Good for you. Eric, good to see you tonight. How are you, my friend?
How are you?
Good. Good, good boy. Everybody's asking.
Good to be here tonight. I think that for me, like implementing these trainings into my life, it's like a very good thing to do. But the thing that I struggle with the most is like what you say, like be gentle with yourself, because I know that thinking about it and having the conceptual part of it in my head is good, but putting it into action is something that sometimes I struggle with, you know, like, I definitely find that I procrastinate a little bit, and, I don't know, it's just, like, doing it is a very rewarding thing.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Even when you recognize procrastination in your Dhamma practice, it's an aspect of regaining control of my mind when I feel like, I don't really feel like meditating. And you just go ahead and meditate anyway, despite what your mind is telling you. Every time you do that, you're deconditioning that conditioned response. I don't want to do this. Or anything else related to Dhamma coming here. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, the more you develop that idea, the more you free yourself of self-loathing, the more free you will be. And the more animated your Dhamma practice will be. Mm-hmm. And that we don't realize what a terrific anchor that is, that view that I have to beat myself up in order to better myself. It's just such nonsense, and it's never helpful. But it's so deeply entrenched in our Western way of thinking and really most of the world. There's still some parts of Southeast Asia, if you said something like, I hate myself, they wouldn't even understand it because they don't have a frame of reference for that type of thinking about yourself. But even with that, when you find yourself judging yourself harshly, the way to be gentle with yourself is to not judge yourself beyond that point and just acknowledge it and come back to the Dhamma. You know, but you're being here and doing all the things you've done. I know Eric for a couple of years now, all the things you've done in the last couple of years have shown how much you do really care for yourself, and you're making a lot of good choices. So good for you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Glad you're here. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see everybody. It's growing. And I have to keep things simple. And, this week has been challenging. And life isn't easy, you know. And if I have a human life and I'm interacting every day, all day with people, and people who don't have a path and who are entangled with the world and reacting and overreacting, and you know, I have to keep a sense of equanimity about me so that I don't become entangled with the world. And I have my own difficulties going on in my life as well that are challenging, and I just have to remember that it's the preoccupation with stress that will keep me distracted and in ignorance and hard to get out of it. And I just have to remember that the task of the first truth is to have an understanding of stress.
Yep.
And the second one is the origin of it is craving and clinging and judging and attached to things. And I have to remember that the path is there for me. And no one said it's going to be easy. You know, and sometimes I got to bring out my machete and, you know, cut away the entanglements and free myself from it. And it's those times of seclusion that we've talked about in the previous classes that I can take a step back, take a 5-minute, focus on my breath, feel the joy, the rapture, the directed thought, directed knowledge, and breathe and let it all go.
Yeah.
And it's been the most important part of my journey here is learning how to let go.
Yeah.
Without judgment.
Without judgment. Yeah. Yeah. That is. I mean, you could kind of boil the Dhamma down to that. What are you willing to let go? Everything. You know, there's nothing to take personal, so there's nothing to hold on to. It is as simple and direct as that. It seemed like an underlying part of our talk tonight was about self-care and the self-care that comes from developing a Dhamma. Thursday night's talk is going to be directly on that from I can't think of the name of the chapter from the Dhammapada. The Janavaga. No, it's not that. Anyway, that doesn't matter, but it's about... What's that?
Sorry. About the right speech aspect of it. When I first came in here, you taught me that was the very first class I think I had was about right speech. And I realized through the last few years that I never knew how. I never had a relationship with myself.
Yeah.
I never knew how to talk to myself properly and therefore talk to other people properly. So when I'm practicing right speech and I'm engaging it with other people, I can really appreciate how I've developed speech with myself too. And
yeah.
It was probably one of the most difficult things that for me to overcome was the negative self-talk and how I, the thoughts,
yeah.
Because I'm not with other people's thoughts. I'm with my own thoughts all day long. And, you know, and how do I interact with that, with those thoughts?
Yeah.
And anyway.
Thank you, Frank. That's such an important part of right speech. The most important part of right speech is the speech we have with the conversations we have with ourselves, because that's really where the rubber hits the road. These the things that we're saying to ourselves, the self sabotage and.
Does the Buddha speak on that directly?
Actually, this what I was going to say. The sutta tomorrow night with Thursday night on is about self-care, but not, it's not specific. It's not if you really want to take care of yourself, you'll go to bed early and sleep 8 hours and drink plenty of water. It's self-care in relation to developing a proper Dhamma practice. And in that way, yes. But when you read even the Buddha's descriptions of right speech and even in relation to right effort, he will say those words. And of course, the most immediate reference is the words that I'm saying to myself. So it's so important. And that's really what we're dealing with in meditation. You know, that whether we recognize it or not, especially in the beginning of meditation, we might not recognize that self-talk are those thoughts that are distracting us. That's self-talk. And whether it's, you know, you should have done this or maybe you'll do that, any train of thought that is distracting that you're caught up in is part of that self-talk, because where the thoughts occurring in your head and they're reflecting on you. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So anytime, the reason why this meditation method works above all others is that every time we come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting that self-talk. We're interrupting that train of thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and we're deepening our concentration. And just like Eric says, we start recognizing when we're not being gentle with ourselves, when we're being hurtful. And the more, and I bet every one of you would say this, and you can answer if you want, the more gentle you are with yourself, the more gentle you are with the people around you, right?
Yeah.
It's just natural. You don't have to try to be a good person. We naturally become that by simply incorporating the Dhamma. Okay.
John, also, if you developed a certain level of sarcastic humor in your life,
yes,
you don't realize how you may think that there's comedy and it's funny and
yep.
But it's really negative.
It's very hurtful.
Talk about yourself and other people.
Yeah, I was very guilty of that. You know, I kind of prided myself on my sarcasm. And the underlying thinking, like, it doesn't really hurt anybody, but it hurts, doesn't it? You know, that type of.
Once in a while, it's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see what the Patimoksha says about that. But
yeah, between irony and sarcasm.
Yeah.
I love good irony.
Yeah, I do too.
There is a fine line where it just quickly slides into sarcasm.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I'm not gonna.
Yeah.
I was going to say something sarcastic, there, but I practiced restraint, so I'm very proud of myself. great class. I'm glad that we got Frank and Eric. It's just 8:30, so we can do meta while you're still here. So let's do that. And just a reminder, the retreat's coming up May 16th to the 20th. If you want to come, please sign up as soon as you can. Meta. So these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Thank you, Jane, for joining us. Peace.
Thank you. Have a good week.
You too. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.